Welcome back to Question Madison 2018. I am Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. And before we get started with this episode, let's start off with a little gem, a little pearl, a little nugget, if you will. Because like I said, it is sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. And that means you're putting on sunscreen. When you're putting on sunscreen, it means you get the SPF. And what are you looking for? You're looking to see what percentage of the UVB, B as in boy, rays that it blocks. So if you have SPF 15, it blocks 93%. If you have SPF 30, it blocks 97%. SPF 50, and you're only at 98%. So when you go from 30 to 50, you're only gaining 1%. But when you go from 15 to 30, you're gaining 4%. I think overall, this kind of goes with all medications that I've ever talked about ever, in that low dose gives you almost 93% of the punch. And it's really not 93%, it's even higher because it's never 100% of the punch. So low dose is still a good dose, or at least better than nothing. And with that little nugget, without any further hesitation, without any further reservation, it is good to be back. All right, welcome back. Question Madison 2018. I am Andrew Bilt down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. So many articles, so little time. So let's jump right in to all of the articles. Now, if you have to pick a place to sleep, I would tell you not to sleep on the concrete. I would tell you not to sleep in the bathtub, and I would tell you not to sleep with your head resting on the toilet. And unfortunately, I also tell most of my patients that they probably shouldn't be sleeping in the hospital. This comes from a study in JAMA, Quality and Quantity of Sleep, and Factors Associated with Sleep Disturbances in Hospitalized Patients. We think that hospitals are good, they're good for care, but turns out they're not good for sleep. When they compared the sleep of hospitalized patients compared with their habitual sleep at home, what do you know? Bada bing, bada boom. Patients or individuals that were in the hospital got about an hour and a half less sleep per night. And not only did they get less sleep per night, they also had one more awakening in the night. So they weren't able to necessarily get through a good solid REM cycle. At home, they're having two nocturnal awakenings, and then in the hospital, they're having three. Now, again, where do those three fall? Is it actually disturbing their REM cycle? That could be debated. But anytime you're waking up more often, we know that that is not good for your sleep habits, which I think just goes to prove that if you're going to be in the hospital, you need to be sick, and this is not a hotel. You got to get home because this is not a place for you to rest, and it's really probably not a place for you to get better. The longer you're there, the longer you're going to be there. In this next article, I think the big take-home, the big gem of evidence-based medicine is that the potential benefit of any therapy is dependent on the relative risk reduction and the patient's global disease risk. That exact line can be found in a paper in JAMA titled Association Between Baseline LDL Level and Total Cardiovascular Mortality After LDL Lowering, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis. Now in this study, if you just go to the conclusion, you'll see that the meta-analysis or the conclusion reference, they're going to say, you know, that intensive LDL or statin therapy, when you could lower down the LDL, was associated with a greater reduction in risk of total and cardiovascular mortality in trials of patients with higher LDL levels. So, hey, if they got a high LDL, get down their LDL to lower and it's going to be better. But then they go on to say this association was not present when baseline LDL levels were less than 100, suggesting that the greatest benefit of LDL lowering therapy may occur for patients with higher baseline LDL levels. What they're trying to say, what they're really trying to say, if you go into the supplemental data and you'll see that it's actually LDL lowering was not beneficial for those with primary prevention, if you find it buried in there, except what they're trying to say is that the potential benefit for any therapy, in this case, statin therapy, is dependent on the relative risk reduction and the patient's global disease risk. Yes, no benefit for primary prevention when you dig into the numbers. Yes, no benefit if their LDL is less than 100. But maybe that's almost saying about the same thing. You have a relatively healthy patient with a low LDL and, you know, doing fine, exercises, primary prevention, hasn't had a heart attack, hasn't had a stroke. These drugs are likely not going to do any good whatsoever. And that's because, again, the potential benefit of any therapy is dependent on the relative risk reduction and the patient's global disease risk. If the patient has a low overall relative risk reduction for a cardiovascular event, well, then the benefit they're going to get from a statin isn't very much. I mean, if you give a 2-year-old a statin and you give it to them for the next 10 years, they're probably not going to have a heart attack. But they probably were not going to have a heart attack whether you gave them a statin or not. However, if you give a 72-year-old a statin, you might be saving a heart attack because the benefit is there because they had a higher relative risk of disease. Now, I have one huge pet peeve in medicine. Well, I actually have way more than just one huge pet peeve in medicine, but one of my biggest pet peeves is when someone says, oh, well, that medicine makes you gain weight. It's not really the medicine that makes you gain weight. It's the amount of food that you put in your body and the change in metabolism, because the medicine itself is, it's actually a very small pill. It weighs less than, you know, nothing. It's just a pill. It in itself is not the thing that makes you gain weight. But this study, a multi-center randomized clinical trial of all different implants of birth control, intrauterine copper devices, looked at the effect on weight variations up to 3 years after placement. This was published in the ever so popular Journal of Contraception, May 2018, and the bottom line is that although the copper IUD looks like it would be heavy, it looks like if one of them is going to make you gain weight, it would be that one. I mean, it's got metal on it. Copper, for God's sakes. But apparently, over 3 years, it actually leads to 2 kilogram less weight gain than the other implantable birth control methods. Quick math, 2 kilograms. I mean, we're looking at roughly 4 or 5 pounds. Is that really worth it? I don't know. I'm not a woman. I've never gained 5 pounds over the course of 3 years that I've really cared about, but your patient might, and that is something to have the shared decision-making conversation with if you think that they're going to freak out that they're going to gain in what would be an extra 5 pounds. If you want to prevent that extra weight gain, you give the copper IUD in comparison to the other IUDs. And while we're talking about women's health, let's move on to platelet counts during pregnancy. This article is in the New England Journal of Medicine, and they were looking to see how low is too low when it comes to platelet counts in pregnant women. Now, we know platelet counts during pregnancy will go down because there's an increase in plasma volume. This is more of a dilutional effect. But as the conclusion in this article states, in women who have a platelet count of less than 100,000, a cause other than pregnancy or its complications should be considered. Now, to put these in different terms, when you actually look at the numbers inside of the trial and you dig deep a little bit, if you had a complicated pregnancy, it was associated with a 200% increase in the number of women with platelet counts below 100,000. A 200% increase odds that you would have a platelet count below 100,000 if you had a complicated pregnancy compared to a non-complicated pregnancy. And that sounds super impressive, except in absolute terms, we're talking about, you know, 1 to 2%. Yes, you might go from 1 and then 200% increase, relatively speaking, is up to 2%. However, it's a lot, and if you have a platelet count less than 100,000, you better work it up for some other things because it's still a double risk increase. And you know what they say, when it rains, it pours. So while we're talking about women's health or a change in men to be a woman's health, let's look at a paper in the Annals of Internal Medicine, Cross-Sex Hormones and Acute Cardiovascular Events in Transgender Persons, a cohort study. This study was hoping to examine the incidence of VTE or venous thromboembolism, ischemic stroke, and myocardial infarction in transgender persons, and they wanted to establish how does the hormones really play into this. Well, bottom line, they said it really sucks to be a woman. Because if you were going from a man to a woman, and you're taking hormone replacement therapy to make you a woman, you had an increased risk of VTE. However, if you were a woman and you wanted to become a man, so you're taking testosterone, you did not have an increased risk of VTE. Reminds me of a quote, and it goes something like, men are from Mars, women are from DVT-ness. Something like that. Anyways, on to the next article. And now for a guideline combination, a 1-2 punch that'll knock your socks off, and probably should be at the end of this podcast because it's pretty awesome. It's when the AAFP, or American Academy of Family Practice, came out and said, in their guidelines on prostate cancer screening, just clear as day, we want family physicians to clearly understand that based on currently available evidence, we do not recommend routine PSA-based prostate cancer screening. The difference between this one and the United States Preventive Services Task Force is that in the task force, they came out and said, well, if you're between the ages of 55 and 69, then you need to have a shared decision-making conversation with your physician, and then you can talk about the risks and benefits, and you can decide if it's worth it. American Academy of Family Physicians has come out and said, listen, this isn't worth it. Don't even have the conversation, because this is not worth it. And I would tend to agree with them. Now, that doesn't mean they can't get the screening done if they really want it, but the American Academy of Family Physicians is saying, don't necessarily need to bring it up to even have the conversation. Here are the numbers that you can take to clinic tomorrow. I'll try to go slow so you can keep up, but they're kind of convoluted and confusing, but let's see if we can get through this. So, let's say we have 1,000 men offered PSA screening. Out of that 1,000, about 25%, or 240, will have a positive PSA result, which may or may not indicate cancer. And as we know, it doesn't all indicate cancer, but about 25% will have cancer. Of those, about 40% or 100 patients will have a positive biopsy showing a definitive cancer. Now, that's when it gets complicated, because you might be saying to yourself, whoa, Andrew, 100 patients out of 1,000 have positive biopsy for cancer. That's huge, except for when you look at the studies, 20 to 50% of these men diagnosed with cancer are diagnosed with a cancer that never grows. It never spreads. It never becomes bigger than what it is. We just go in with a biopsy. We stick it in. You knock you out. We get this tissue and we say, oh my goodness, you have cancer. But up to 50% or as low as 20% of the time, it's just benign. It's like your appendix. It's just sitting there doing nothing. Well, of the 100 people that we tell have cancer, as we know from other studies, they can't just live with a diagnosis of cancer. They have to get it out of them. So 80 of the 100, or 80%, will roughly choose to have surgery or radiation treatment. Out of those 80, 50, or a large percent, will have erectile dysfunction, 15% will have urinary incontinence, and when it all boils down, out of the original 1,000 patients, 3 patients will avoid cancer spreading to other organs or metastatic prostate cancer, 1 patient avoids death from prostate cancer, and 5 patients die from prostate cancer even after we do surgery, even after we do chemo and radiation. 5 patients still die out of that original 1,000. Now, is it worth it? I don't know. But here's what you can say. Out of 1,000 patients, we're going to save 1 life, and we're looking at a 50 out of 1,000 that will have erectile dysfunction. That'll typically end it for most men. 5 patients out of 1,000 will still die of prostate cancer no matter what we do. It doesn't even matter if we test them to begin with. They're just going to die from prostate cancer. And 80 patients will undergo surgery or radiation treatment. And again, I know the treatments are getting better. I know we're getting more precise in our measurements and our radiation and pinpoint laser beams. But to me, I just don't think it's worth it. But I'll leave it up to you, and I'll leave it up to the patient. In the very near future, I'll have a big announcement coming, and you'll probably hear a lot of me talking about, at least in one episode, talking about gout as I'm currently reading the guidelines of gout. However, here's something I found quite interesting. In the BMJ It is a paper titled Relationships Between Serum Urate Concentration and Clinically Evident Incident Gout, an Individual Participant Data Analysis. Here's what it did. It looked at the analysis of almost 19,000 patients who were clear of gout, had their uric acid level, and then it followed them. This was the cool part. With over 200,000 patient years of follow-up, they looked at what was the likelihood that your, based on your serum urate concentration or serum urate levels, which is what we say, we got to get the urate levels lower because the lower we get it, the more gout-free time that you'll have. Well, what were the odds that if you had it lower than 6, what were the odds that you'd have gout? If you had it lower or greater than 10, what were the odds you'd have gout? Now, if you'd ask me, I would say if you had it greater than 10 for a couple years, oh man, goodness gracious, you are going to have ridiculous cases of gout. But it turns out, not so fast. Even if you had uric acid levels greater than 10, only about half of those patients developed clinically evident gout over 15 years, meaning that there's probably other factors that go into whether you get gout or not. What those factors are, I don't know. I don't think anyone knows. But I think that when we go back and look at the American College of Physician guidelines from just a couple years ago where they said, listen, we don't know if you should be treating to a target because we don't really have evidence that this does anything, they might have been on to something. Although every rheumatologist is going to hate that. Now, sometimes I got to admit, I look at the medications that are prescribed for certain diseases and I think to myself, what was that provider thinking? And sometimes I think that giving opioids for an ankle sprain is one of those times where I hit myself in the forehead and say, what was that provider thinking? Opioids really seems a little bit extreme, but I know that it's done. And it was especially done in this paper, Academic Emergency Medicine, National Variation in Opioid Prescribing and Risk of Prolonged Use for Opioid-Naive Patients Treated in the Emergency Department for Ankle Sprains. What they did is they looked at ankle sprains and then they looked at if you were to get opioids. And if you got opioids and you're opioid-naive, what are the odds or what is the risk that you would then become a prolonged user of opioids? Now, we know we have an opioid epidemic, so you would think that you'd want to give them the minimum amount of opioids necessary. When he looks at the graphs, if you had a prescription for this ankle sprain of less than 10 Percocets, your risk of prolonged use of opioids was 1.2%. But if you had a prescription for more than 30 Percocets, your prolonged risk was almost 600 times more at 6.3%. I think that this goes with the guidelines, it goes with the recommendations, and it kind of goes with what we all know. Give the shortest duration, the shortest amount of opioids you can if you're going to give opioids to prevent prolonged use. It's been shown over and over, and it's shown again here. This next article could fall under the title of Media Fake News. It is a paper in JAMA titled Association of Early Introduction of Solids with Infant Sleep, a secondary analysis of a randomized clinical trial. And if you just read the fake news, if you just read the headlines, you would see that, oh my goodness, giving kids foods early, solid foods early, actually at 3 months versus 6 months leads to increased sleep time. So all you gotta do with mom is give the kid solid food early and there you go, bada bing, bada boom, the kid will sleep through the night like a baby. You'll be happy as a clam. And except for, if you read the paper, if you go into the paper, the real numbers are it's about 20 minutes. 20 minutes. Yes, if you give your kids solid foods at 3 months versus 6 months, you will get less than one Netflix episode of extra sleep, plus about two less awakenings per week. This is one of those things that grabs your headlines because you want kids to sleep. Everyone wants them to sleep, but 20 extra minutes. And I don't have children, so I can't speak. But some people on Twitter reached out to me and they said, listen, 20 extra minutes sounds like heaven, and I would do anything for 20 extra minutes. So I guess when we get there, or when I get there, I'll let you know if that's actually clinically relevant, but it definitely was statistically relevant. All right, I'm coming up on 20 minutes, so let me do one more big jump, one more big deep dive that I think we all need to know, and then I will close this as I have closed every podcast before it. So, last but not least, here we go. It is a paper in JAMA 2018 titled Effect of Home-Based Wearable Continuous ECG Monitoring Patch on Detection of Undiagnosed Atrial Fibrillation, the mSToPS Randomized Clinical Trial. Now, you might have heard about this. It created quite a fuss in the media and Twitter and all that. But here's what you need to know. Patients were recruited from 2015 to 2016. The eligible participants were basically your grandma and grandpa. Were 75 years of age or older, of any sex, or a female greater than 55 years of age, or a male greater than 65 years of age with comorbidities. So healthy 75-year-old or older, or some comorbid conditions in 55 or 65. Now, the participants were excluded if they had a prior diagnosis of atrial fibrillation, a flutter, atrial tachycardia, if they had an implantable pacemaker, defibrillator. So basically, they just wanted you to have a normal heart rhythm and be either at risk, just be at risk. At risk, or, you know, what we would think not really at risk, but older, which I guess still puts you at risk. Then in this randomized trial, they took just over 1,700 patients using the continuous EKG monitoring. And then they randomized, for every one patient that was wearing the continuous monitoring, they randomized two patients to be the control or observational group. Now, surprise, surprise, those individuals who had the continuous monitor were found to have more events of atrial fibrillation. I mean, I guess I don't know what else we would expect, but of course they had more. The numbers were a little shocking, though. AFib was newly diagnosed in 6.3% of patients wearing the EKG monitoring patch, compared to only 2% in the control group receiving just regular old routine care. Now, out of that 6.3%, or 109 patients that were diagnosed wearing the patch, 65 were found to have AFib through the EKG patch, with the remainder, or right about 45, diagnosed in the clinical setting. And this likely wasn't very serious AFib, or at least the majority of patients diagnosed with AFib had a relatively low burden of AFib, with only 4.3% having persistent AFib. Now, everyone was up in arms saying, look at this, we should be maybe using this to search for AFib in these high-risk population. This population that we don't know has AFib, but we don't know because we don't look. So maybe we should start looking. And then comes a wonderful piece by Dr. John Mandrola that just came out August 7th, titled Screening for Atrial Fibrillation Comes with Many Snags. You should just Google it. I believe it's open access for everyone. And it is awesome. If you're going to read one article in the next month, this is the one I think that you should read, because it's so well written, and it lays out what I think is really a problem with not only AFib screening, but all screening in general. And one of the quotes in the paper is, in theory, screening is an admirable method of combating disease, but in practice, there are snags. And there are so many snags. And for example, with this AFib screening, we have to do more than just pick up arrhythmia and increase the number of anticoagulation drugs that we're prescribing. But we have to actually know that using the anticoagulation drugs makes a difference in the outcomes that we care about. Else, why screen them if it's not going to make a difference that we care about? So they go through the numbers, and the numbers of how can we tell? I mean, really, we have to look at the number needed to diagnose one new case of atrial fibrillation by the number needed to treat with anticoagulation to prevent one stroke. Because even if we find everyone with atrial fibrillation, remember, the number needed to treat with anticoagulation is never one. It's not everyone's going to reach benefit. Not everyone's going to be protected from a stroke. Even those on anticoagulation still have strokes. He gives the numbers. I'm not going to break it down completely, but basically, the number needed to screen to prevent one stroke in this calculation, which he breaks down, is one stroke is equal to 10,000 individual screen. Now, for comparison, the authors go on to say that the number needed to screen for abdominal aortic aneurysms to save one disease-specific death is 250. For fecal occult blood testing, The number needed to screen is 625. And if you march this AFib screening out into cost analysis, then the numbers get even more sobering. They get even scarier because if a number needed to screen of 1 in 10,000 wasn't enough, let's just assume that EKG roughly costs $80 to $100 for insurance purposes. Society would have to pay around $1 million to prevent one stroke in a person older than 75 years old. I mean, come on. That is just too much money. It's too much time. It's too much resources invested in one area to really make this a standard of practice. I think in the end, it all boils down to we all want to do well. We all want to do good. But when you have studies like this screening for AFib, and it is really screening to find a risk factor, AFib, for a disease, and not really finding does that do anything to the disease, while the trial may create a lot of media, while it creates a lot of press and interesting conversations around the water cooler, it is of little utility when it comes to clinical practice. And I will leave you with that nugget, I will leave you with that pearl, and I'll wrap this episode up. And I will end it as I have ended every episode before it. Until next time, keep the quest in questioning.